Welcome to the Centerline Podcast for April 2021. This is Alan Bakkel and Nami Wallace, Iowa Department for the Blind Orientation Center. This discussion is had with Emily Wharton, the director of the Iowa Department for the Blind, about the recording commonly known as the dishwashing tape. This tape or recording is used in several centers around the country for training purposes. I hope you enjoy. Well, Emily, welcome to the podcast. I'm hoping that you refreshed on the dishwashing tape.
I did.
Was that a blast from the past?
It was. It's taking me back to first listening to it as a student going into the orientation center.
Did you listen to the whole thing as a student? Did you pay attention?
I don't believe that I did.
And just
I was 23, and I don't think I fully paid attention to a lot of things.
So I was thinking, so Emily Wharton, director of the Iowa Department for the Blind, is our guest today on the podcast. Emily came through the orientation center in Iowa a couple years before me.
1998,
and I was in 02. So our experiences were relatively the same. Some stuff, I don't know, we compare from time to time. But I remember the dishwashing tape when I first was asked to listen to it. There was no explanation surrounding it as to what it was. It was,
oh, that bothers me.
There was here, I'm going to have you listen to this. And it was my first day. And so I had just started in the center. I got sleep shades on. I still don't think I'm a blind person at this point, but I'm here for some reason. And here, listen to this tape from 1903. At least that was what went through my head. And then I was expecting to hear like the Victrola, like the record player thing going, and the Charleston. Anyway, my point is, there was no story around it, no reference around it. And I know that one nowadays in the center, when anybody listens to the dishwashing tape, we still use it, which is why I really wanted to do this as a podcast as well. But we do kind of give a little bit of the background so people understand at least a little bit about what they're listening to. Otherwise, they're lost. So you're saying first time you listened to it, Emily, what were your initial thoughts? Because I know you probably paid attention to about half of it, but.
Yeah, I don't know that I did. I mean, I think that I picked up on the issues surrounding hierarchy of sight. I recognized that that was going to be an issue or a topic. And it was maybe perhaps a little intellectually interesting to me, but as you know, I wasn't really blind, just like you. So yes. I don't know that it really pertained to me at the time. I was, you know, a little, but I do think I caught bits and pieces of it. I do think I reflected back on it from time to time, but not to the extent that I would have liked to have done. Had there been the framing there to understand what I was listening to and why I was listening to it. Because a lot of times obviously throughout my training, the issue of the hierarchy of sight and the primacy of sight, sight is right and sight is most important, was going to come up repeatedly because I was going to believe that for quite some time. So it was going to cause me some, you know, ongoing issues in my training. So
and you and I have talked about, like, I know some specific examples that you've used before, and we'll probably get to those, like, in that part of it when we talk about that. But just specific, almost in the center where that was reinforced, even though it was kind of said, we're not going to have the hierarchy of sight here. So I know some specific things that you've mentioned before in conversations in the past to where it was almost the hierarchy was actually reinforced here at the center. not on purpose, obviously, but that it oftentimes probably isn't enforced on purpose. So Nami, you were born here at the building, lived in the building your entire life. Not sure you ever got out, but when was the first time you actually heard this tape?
The first time I heard this, I was doing an internship at the Colorado Center for the Blind while in college. So it wasn't even here that I heard it for the first time. And they had all of their summer staff listen to it. And then we had a group discussion about it.
That was the first time you heard it. What were you thinking when you heard this for the first time? Because
go Iowa. I live there.
Was born in that building. and I
felt pretty cool, actually. I was like, yeah, I knew Jernigan. Very little, but I knew Jernigan.
Nami is like furniture around here, so she's been here a while. She's like the old chairs. I was thinking when I was listening to this, so I did the refresher, much like you as well. I was thinking about the furniture that was in the director's conference room that we have just recently kind of replaced. And I was thinking that probably was the same furniture that they were sitting on while they were banging their pipes and stuff. So getting into it, though, number one reason Jernigan says to have a center, or the reason for the center, which I always...
in his mind and emotions.
Yes.
He really can be independent again.
Yes. Right.
That philosophy of blindness, that positive philosophy.
It's the positive philosophy. It's the true belief, right? That in a person. I always I end up altering this somehow sometimes when I'm talking, and I really need to not. Mainly because I sit there and I was like, well, it's attitude, it's confidence, it's, you know, it's that belief in blindness. It's that belief in the skills. And then the second thing, of course, where he's talking, which is the, since this is not a test, Emily, the second thing is the
skill. I took notes. Did
you?
Yes.
Awesome. You know, the skills training itself, which those are the two easy ones, right, to think about. Do we have any argument about those two things? I don't know that anybody ever seems to.
Well, and I think those two things really go hand in hand, because it's hard to build the confidence and the belief in what a blind person can do if you haven't learned or started learning those skills. And as you build the confidence, you're more likely to try those things that you might have been afraid of trying before. So I think those two, you really can't have one without the other.
So Emily, I'm going to put you on the spot here, because this is a question that gets asked all the time, or we do at times quite a bit. What is more important out of those two?
You know, I you know how that business class ends up. When you get the students divided up and they argue the points, and they argue them very vehemently and very well. And then at the end of the class, everybody's going to decide that they're both important and that you really can't have one without the other. And I've never seen it not end that way over, the past 20 some years. because I don't know that I can, because as Nami said, I really do think that you have to have them both, and you can't, but I've seen people go out into the world with a positive attitude towards blindness where they've had some real significant challenges on their skills, that they've got, something going on where they are just really challenged directionally. There's just something that really struggle with mental mapping and different travel skills. And yet, because they have the belief in themselves and their abilities, they will go out into the world and will figure out strategies to get to where they need to be. They'll figure out a way to get the egg rolls at the state fair if that's what they really want. You know, they may have to ask 16 people to get there, but they'll, you know, they'll do it. They won't be the beautiful travel skills that they would maybe want to have or have worked to do and very hard and tried to have. I've known several people like that because the, you know, the sheer force of their attitude will push through their skill deficits. And I'm trying to think of an example of the other way around, and I don't know that I can, as somebody whose skills are so good that their attitude doesn't matter.
I 100% agree with you on that one. I think of the two, that confidence component, that belief in yourself, I think is the more important. I can't find a more eloquent way of putting it. The more important of the two for exactly those reasons. There might be a lot more problem solving. It might not be as finesse and fluid looking, but they get the job done because they believe that they can do it.
Yeah. And so they're going to use some strategies that we're not going to think of necessarily as, you know, the canonical blindness skills, right? They, you know, might end up using more sighted guide, more sighted assistance than, you know, than what we would want, you know, folks coming out of the orientation center to have, you know, and use, but that's, they're figuring it out what they need to do and getting from the, to where they need to be and achieving what they want to achieve in life.
So I always look at this in kind of a, I don't know, I think about a finance class at Drake, so I won't bore you guys on that. But the whole thing that I think about sometimes with the skills versus attitude, right, or combining them, skills along with attitude, sometimes I find where the skills part of that is, or the attitude part of that is, as one of those increases, it pulls the other one up, right? So if you think about, maybe there are times where it's 60-40, right, in one way or the other. But as long as you're continuing to push, right, as long as you're kind of that, I always think of it that it is pushing you forward. It is pulling you up. As the skills get better, the attitude probably will increase. As the attitude gets better and the confidence starts to grow with that, then you're out more and you're using those skills more and they continue to increase. And so, you know, for me, it's kind of that continual build, and hopefully in an upward arc. The opposite of true is that, I guess, which would be, if you still see people who never use the skills, and let's say the skills diminish, right? Let's say, the one thing that lots and lots of centers have always faced is someone leaves and, you know, and we've put in that post-center plan to combat this, but go home, you sit on the couch, your skills slowly go down. So does the attitude along with it. So just very, very much joined at the hip between those two things, I think, as well as having that, there's some personal drive and that kind of thing that goes along with it, I think. So, all right. In looking at the next part of it, which talks about educating the public, and Nami, you can go ahead and say your favorite quote from the dishwashing tape, which I happen to know.
Well, I have two favorite quotes, but they're both about the public. The one that, whereas if you weren't so stupid, you'd know better. And along those same lines is, you stupid mutthead.
We had to get those out of the way, Emily, because she brings them up and bites at the bit to do it. So
I do.
I figured we would just go ahead with them right now.
Just get those out of the way.
Well, and I always love the way that he does bring this up, right? And he kind of makes a comment about it where he's like, I guess I can't come to you from the side anymore. Cause you know, he's bringing up this other stuff to bring up his final thoughts on this or his real meaning. So the whole public education, right. And who that pertains to, which he's talking, who does the public include? It includes the people that are out there, it includes family, and it includes students as well. I don't know that we Does anybody think we don't do enough around the center? I have an opinion on this, in the way of educating the public.
I think we can always improve on it. And I mean, that's why I strongly push for getting out and about and doing the activities that we're doing. And because if we're not out there being seen, living normal lives, going to the fair or whatever the heck it is, you know, the public's perception isn't being challenged.
And I look at it even mostly from the student standpoint of the experiences that they need to have. You know, in looking at the mall experiences that you had recently, yeah. Going to that, right? The way I put it in coffee talk to all staff is like, if you happen to be in one of these times because COVID has kind of hit this hard and made this more challenging, right, to get out there. If you happen to have gone through training in a time where you didn't get to have an experience like this, I'd invite you to come do that. Because to me, that is in staff training in particular, it's such a huge part of experiencing being treated badly and learning how to handle that in a calm, measured, and helpful way that's going to turn them around, you know, as Jernigan described on the tape. That is a skill and an art form that really needs to be mastered, but also to get, you know, just going back from the staff trainee standpoint of it, I want them to know what that feels like, to have that feeling of being grabbed, of being told that you can't come into a store because you might break something. I want them to have that emotional feeling like this is the thing that's happening to me. And so that they can understand when they're working with their clients and their colleagues that this is a thing that people are dealing with and experiencing. And that really brings home so much of the experience about what it means to be a blind person in, you know, America today. Not that that's every day that is what's going on, but it's a regular occurrence, you know?
It is. But I agree with you. It takes encountering those, because if you leave the orientation center and you've not encountered those, and then you're faced with that and you don't have those skills built up, it can be hard. I really like how Jernigan put it. You know, it's not just the public component. It's understanding why the public attitude is the way it is, getting to a point where it doesn't hurt you or throw you, and then conducting yourself in a way that you don't, how did he put it, don't encourage those same stigmas or belief about blind people.
Yeah. And, you know, and I did have to talk to one of the staff people, because one of the staff who was in training, not a blind person, you know, goes to a store, not allowed in. And the things that were coming out of that person's mouth, which they were getting it. But I did have this talk, because part of it was, I'm friends with blind people and this is how they're treated. And this just makes me feel like crappy for them that you're friends with me. I was like, and I was kind of pointing out, I was like, well, you got to understand, at the time you're the blind person. I was like, you were being discriminated against. It wasn't your friends. It was you. And, you know, does that change anything? And I think for the person it did somewhat, right? It's, you know, somebody who's never been discriminated against in your life. I think there are a lot of flood of emotions that come through that, that does take some time to kind of probably even sort through. Now the other bothersome side of this is, it's like, I always sort of say, well, geez, someone said to me one time, it's like, well, he's kind of saying you should get used to it. And, I don't think that's what he's saying necessarily. Getting used to it, I don't believe is what Jernigan's talking about necessarily in there. It's being able to deal with it and in a positive manner.
Well, I mean, I would say, yes, he is saying to get used to it too, because it's not going away.
I don't want to think that way, Emily.
Well, it is going away and it is better. And I would argue that it's better now than it was when this was recorded. But we're still noticing it, right? It's still here. So I would like to believe that 20 years from now, that it's not a thing. But, you know, I don't think that, you know, in the next 10 or whatever, that it will be, because it is such a, we're fighting a really big uphill battle with this. What he's saying is you do have to get used to it, because you're going to, you need to stand strong and not let this wreck you. Right. But also that you need to be part of the change that needs to happen in getting folks to come to a different perception, taking everything that they saw on TV, all their, you know, their images of blind people, you know, that they've stored up. They've got this little file card in this head in their head about how blind people are. And your job is to try and alter that file card as best you can and get them to be on the plus side rather than the minus side in the world. And we're kind of doing that one interaction time, one person at a time. And it seems like, you know, drops in the ocean a lot of the time. So you do, you know, you want to be able to steel yourself for that. And, you know, but you also want to know that you are making a difference and that it is getting better. It just is a long process.
Well, and I mean, if you think of it too, this was recorded in like the late 60s and it's 2021 and we're still faced with a lot of these same things today. I mean, just the other week when we were at the mall and the store owner said, no, you can't come in here because you can break something. I mean, it's still so relevant today. I do see that change is happening, but I wish it was happening a lot faster.
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, a little bit of a side note, as you listen to this, it is interesting because anymore you kind of, I pay more attention to the he, she, them, you know, as far as the pronoun usage. He starts out by saying you people, or yeah, I think it's you people. Is it you people? Yeah, I think he says people a lot. And, but then anytime there's an example, he uses the pronoun he.
So yeah, all blind people are male.
It's good to know. Emily,
yeah, all people are male. I really on this one, but.
All blind people are male. He does get to a point where he says he or she. Nonetheless, you know, you sit there and even up to a few years ago, that wouldn't have been even a thing that would cross anybody's mind listening to this, that it would stick out. And as far as inclusion and so that's changing. It gives you some hope that as things push forward, you know, that hopefully the perceptions about blindness change some. And it's taken a long time. And I think the further down you are, at least in the minorities, the more time it takes maybe to change or something. But it does take actively working on changing this thing. And so I guess my point behind, like with the center, we do a lot of passive, at least what I would consider passive education, right, of the public. Meaning students are on travel and people see them, or students are on travel and they have interactions. There's even, you know, we do occasionally bring people in. We obviously COVID changed a lot of things, so I don't want to like dwell on that part of it, but I don't know, you know, I'm looking forward to getting back to where we're actually doing some more active changing of perceptions.
We've done a handful every year. We do a handful of speaking engagements for like elementary schools and yep. middle schools. And I do notice, I mean, I've been doing these activities in schools for like 9 years, and I have noticed like a change in that for the better. One of the last ones I did, which was like 2020 kind of sucked, but really? I started out with, yeah, who'd have thought, right? No one knew that.
It's over, just get over it.
I always start out with asking the kids what, when they hear the word blind, what do they think of? And they throw out things like daredevil and what are we doing? Guide dog and stuff like that. Can't see, right? And the last couple ones, I had a kid who yelled normal person. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's awesome. The fact that like there is that shift, especially with like our kids, that like it's not like this horrible thing.
Come on, who is this kid that throws out normal person? All right, maybe you're.
It happened. It happened.
That is awesome.
Like, did you pay that child before you went?
I didn't. I was like, who are you? I want your name.
No. I say you got to bring candy and hand it out.
I do remember his name was Will, because at the end I always write out, you know, we slate the kids' names, and he was really disappointed because his name only took up one cell. It was just the letter W.
You could have gave him William or something, Nami. All right. He said
his name on his birth certificate was Will.
I think, you know, my point behind it is it'll be nice to be getting back out and doing some more of those. And it's partly for students too, right? So students who are in the center. And I don't mean it just in the way of going and talking to people. Like, I mean it, you know, more in the way of like doing volunteer work, which we are making a more of an effort to do, which that ends up, you know, I think about the Habitat for Humanity stuff that we did. That was an educating experience, right? And it was direct. What I kind of feel was more direct, not so much a passive. I think it starts with direct and then actually going and doing it. I think the passive part of that was more impactful, obviously, working together with people throughout the day. Zach, our travel instructor, still reminds me we have a lot more work to do in that area, because I think he actually wants to build a house, not just a deck type of thing. So he wants to, I don't know whether he's wanting to put a roof on in a day. I don't know what he's wanting to do, but harder stuff is what I think he wants to do. And with your
example of the Habitat for Humanity builds that we've done, I mean, starting out, they're like, I just don't know how a blind person can do this. So they came and toured and we had those discussions. And then when we were done with it, they came back saying, you guys were the hardest working team we've had out here forever. So it really did change their perception.
Yeah. When are you coming back? So, you know, that was more direct, and I think it's beneficial. I still say it probably doesn't happen enough, you know, but we do what we can. But then again, you sit there and say, well, you're just a small group. And it's like, yeah, but one person can change a lot. We led into what he then was kind of getting around to about the, he did this kind of in a roundabout way eventually to where he wanted to get at that end, but he's bringing in some talking about the hierarchy of sight. And Emily, do you want to tell me about when they sent a staff person in training to come get you while you were in training?
So travel was my most challenging class by a long shot. And I was a ridiculous peaker. and I struggled because I would get frustrated because I hated being lost. I was very concerned about how I appeared, you know, and so was, you know, but I was lost one day. And so there was this.
Normal people don't get lost, right?
Yeah. No, they don't. So one day I was in the skyways and I wasn't paying attention to the directions I was given. Go figure. I knew where I needed to go, but I couldn't remember how to get there. And so I went up to one of those maps in you know, those You Are Here maps.
Yeah.
I had my face right up against it. I could feel the heat coming off of it, trying to read it. And behind me, I could hear a travel instructor saying, "That's not going to help." I said, "It might if you just leave me alone." So I was bad. I was a ridiculous student. The kind of student I would come to have later, and I would understand karma fully. But when I was teaching travel, but the one day there was a staff trainee who was sent out to find me, and that staff trainee was sent out without sleep shades. Just as a side person, just like go, the travel instructor is busy, so just go find me. And so that made a huge impression on me of like, oh, well, so I guess there's just different standards here. And, you know, we're just going to treat the sighted people differently and they can just go ahead and use their sight. And I was livid.
They basically sent a sighted person in travel. Mm-hmm. Well, they were a staff in training, right? Sighted mm-hmm. staff in training. Mm-hmm. And it was okay then while they were in training to just go ahead and take their sleep shades off and then go find you mm-hmm. visually.
Yeah. And I got back and I told my travel instructor exactly what I thought about that. And I think he recognized that and learned not to do that again. But that's something that it always stuck in my head as just because anytime you have anything that in the center, you have to be so careful about hypocrisy. Because you get particularly a student like me who's going to be so on that. But just I think it impacts everybody that you need to live by what you say. Because where actions speak so much louder than words.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was doing a business class. The last couple of days was kind of around ADA and equal access and into goods and services. And then about go-karting. Okay. Blind people going go-karting. Do they have to let you go-karting? Which, by the way, as one of the YATP students was coming by, Brett, he heard me say, we're going go-karting. And he's like, yes. And I'm like, oh. All right, Brett's going with us. So, but part of what the discussion was around, and I was seeing if, because there are some people and they do go-karting where you've got a sighted guide who's not on the track with you. They're off to the side and they're talking to you through an earpiece. Okay. And no one brought up anything about, okay, well, you're using a sighted guide. And that was a little disappointing to me, although I did get it around. Finally, I got one of the students to say, well, I don't understand because I thought we were trying to not use vision in the center. And so I was so happy that finally someone kind of came around to it. It took a while. And then that does help with the discussion then of, are there times where vision and in talking about vision in the center, why we wear sleep shades and all that. And why do we not allow service dog or guide dogs in the center? And the main reason, behind that is because they're using vision to accomplish the tasks and taking vision out of the equation is so important in that. It goes back to the hierarchy of sight as well, but just in the overall as to what a blind person believes about themselves and in a number of facets. And this can come, like, I think from all different angles when you're in the center and keeping that in mind. So is that an alternative? Is that a fair way of going go-karting? Is that, is go-karting important? There's all kinds of different takes on it, and it's a different podcast probably for sure. But the fact if to do something you need to use vision, is that the only way to do it? That type of thing. But also keeping some of those, when we talk about the hierarchy of sight and what we talk about in the center, and trying to make sure that we're always kind of keeping and we're beating our drum because it's what we believe in. And not waning from that, and then being able to explain. So if someone says, well, why would you do it this way with vision? Or, how come it's okay to use a live reader and their vision, but it's not okay for me to use vision in other areas or take sighted guide, and maybe I have to get someone at the store to be, customer service, and then I go get a shopping assistant, they're using vision. So there's all those questions, but being able to answer them, and I don't know, for me it always comes down to choice and actually being able to have the choice. But
that's really interesting to me, because to me it comes down to control. And going back to the issue, and then, I'm always going to point back to the Karen Fiedering readers, that article.
Oh, yeah.
around this, but I do believe, I mean, the thing is learning to use, you know, there's a lot of pushback, you know, like, well, we got, you know, the phone can read the thing and the, you know, all that, but learning to use and manage a sighted reader is not something that's going to go away. And I would argue that if you are, you know, doing a go-kart with an earpiece and having a person on the side, that person is your, the reader of that track.
Right.
And you are required, and you are, you darn well better be working with them in a relationship where they are in that, that reader relationship where you are in control of the situation. You're getting the information that you need. You're not a passive recipient of whatever they're choosing to bestow on you. Like the employer-employee kind of relationship of it, because you're going to crash if you weren't getting that right information there.
Yeah.
So, and
control is a better word than choice. Choice for me is that same kind of thing. I was meaning more towards that, but yeah, control is a better word for it. So,
yeah, I agree. I mean, I think independence and autonomy is being in control of the quantity and quality of information you're getting. So if you're hired someone to be a driver, you know exactly when they're going to be there. You are the employer. Same with a reader. Hopefully, you know, I like how Emily put it, like, you need to be in control of what information you're getting on that track, otherwise you're going to crash. I really like Jernigan in this, he points out he's like, I honestly don't know who's total and who's partial because we only take blind people in the center. I love that. This is not the commission for the blind and other, it's the commission for the blind. But he does point out, he's like, I never said vision is not helpful and that if you have vision, how dare you, you cannot use it. But he does say, in order to make that educated decision as to what is most effective and efficient at what time, you have to learn those non-visual techniques and you have to become comfortable with those non-visual techniques and skills. Otherwise, you can't make that educated decision on your own.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell people, like, you've had a whole lifetime to learn how to see. You're probably pretty, if you've had vision in your life, you probably figured it out. You opened up your eyes and then the light came in and whatnot. So you pretty much mastered that one. But the non-visual ones, you probably had very little practice with. And so this is why we're going to hit those very hard for this very concentrated amount of time while you're in the center or while you're doing training, because you need to give them equal time and equal evaluation. Because, you know, you're gonna go on from the center and go on in your life. And I can tell you there are things that I still, less and less as my vision decreases, but there's still things that I will do visually because it is more efficient. But I know the non-visual way to do it. And I would use that if that, when it becomes the way to do it, the more efficient way to do it. And those are choices you're going to have to make for the rest of your life. And I really like how he, and I think that's something that I know that I totally overlooked when I first heard it as a student. But understanding that piece of it, that, you know, it's not, we're not saying sight is evil or wrong or anything like that. It's just saying that you got to give this other stuff a fair chance. And that's what you're here for. The center isn't real life. it's the center, you know, it's we're trying to make it like work, a work type situation to learn those work skills. Right. But it's a place where you're working really, really hard to get these specific skills and this particular attitude. And that's what you're there for. So you're not, it's not real life and it's not fair. So not that life is fair either, but the center sure isn't fair.
Yeah. I talk when students come in a lot of times or someone's coming in and they're thinking about coming into the center and then, you know, the big question about shades is always there. I mean, it's in people's heads, even if they don't say it. You know, a lot of times what I'll tell them that I'm the only thing I'm trying to do is get them to look at using non-visual techniques as their primary and visual techniques as their secondary rather than the other way around, because they wouldn't be in my office if the visual techniques were working perfectly for them. It's not that, we NAMI tells people, it's like, well, if this was all easy, we'd give you a pamphlet and send you home. which I always like hearing her say to people, but that is one of the things I've heard from time to time. So I get into these like discussions and it's always just I don't even know why. I kind of always want to like walk away, but then I can't because I'm forced to argue it because I can't walk away. You know, the whole thing about, well, why wouldn't you just teach somebody how to use their vision to the best of their ability? Like, they have the vision. Why are you ignoring it? Once I get done like composing myself and getting back together with it, and I talk about all the same things that we talk about all the time, but then at the whole time I'm sitting there saying, but this, I can usually tell that this person's either buying into it or not based off of their own beliefs before they came to the discussion. There was a girl who, you know, was total, who was like telling me that we should teach people with vision how to use their vision. She'd lost her vision at her late teenage years. She was accomplished and had done a lot of stuff. And I'm trying to like figure out why she was coming at me from that angle. I never, still to this day, have not quite figured it out. And I'm not willing to like call her and argue with her about it anymore. But
my theory on that, though, is because of, I think it's holding on to the primacy of vision, you know, the vision, that blindness techniques are not alternative techniques. They're lesser. And holding on to that. And to me, I've always been baffled by that. We need to teach people how to use a remaining vision. I've just never encountered a blind person within the, you know, 20 some years I've been in this business who didn't know how to use their residual vision. The blindness skills are the stuff that they don't know, or the things that they aren't thinking of, because the whole world is geared around sight. Everything's set up to be visual. It's not like you're not having opportunities to do things visually and that you haven't, and that you haven't tried. Because obviously by the time they get to coming into the center and doing a tour, they've tried everything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard from people, like, I've gotten to a point where my vision can only take me so far and I'm falling behind, or I'm finding myself in unsafe situations. My vision can only help me so much. And other than that, I'm at a loss. And so I agree. Like, I really love how you put it, Emily, like, you were born with the vision you have. No one said, okay, let's sit down and teach you how to like look through your eyeball. Like, you know, you already know this, but it's those non-visual techniques. I really like how Jernigan says, he says, you know, the danger, is that people who have usable vision, they really want to like use that vision even when it's not safe or reliable. I often give people a couple examples of, okay, you've come to a staircase and you don't have that depth perception. Do you bend over the staircase to find that step, which I have seen?
Well, yeah, I know.
Or do you use a cane to locate that first step and confidently take that step down? Another example being, you're frying chicken on your stovetop. There's a vat of oil and the knobs are behind it. Do you lean over that vat of oil to look at the knob, which I have seen, or do you have it labeled so you just quickly find the position you want and turn it on or off? Like, but if you don't know those simple skills or techniques, you don't even know where to start with that. You're going to rely on what vision you have, even though it's not safe.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the bending over the hot vat of oil, because when we were picking up new stoves for our new kitchens, which they needed to be ADA compliant, which puts the knobs and all the controls at the front. And, you know, a lot of times on gas ones, they're there anyway, but there's times where the gas stoves, they're in the back. And the number of people that I've seen lean over a gas stove with like the flames coming up and then singe their hair or catch their hair on fire, former director of the center was honest about and said, yeah, I leaned over and caught my hair on fire. Which I always picked on her after that, because I was like, is that why you keep your hair short? And she was pretty much total by the time I met her. So, go ahead, Emily. Sorry.
Well, and so here's the thing, and I'm probably going to get pushback on this, but as somebody who throughout elementary school, they were trying to teach me to see better. and to get me to use my vision better. And they were doing all kinds of tests on me to try and figure out how to get me to see better. It was exhausting, and it was extraordinarily disappointing because it didn't work, and it would leave me frustrated and feeling like I'm like, oh, so this doesn't work. So I'm completely up a crick. There's nothing else I can do. It is so often, you know, when you show somebody, like, not even saying like that, you know, just how marking your stove, people are like, oh, duh, you know, like I should have thought of that. Like that is so simple and easy. And why doesn't everybody do that? And why don't stoves actually just come that way?
They should.
It just makes so much sense that you just put raised marks on the stove. But you know, but they didn't think of it. And the reason they didn't think of it is because we're just set up, we're wired, the world is set up for us to do things visually. So we're not going to think about it. And so that's why they come to the center. And that's why folks come to us, because we've thought about it. We're going to, and that's what they, you know, and so, you know, they can make that, that informed choice about whether they want to lean over that vat of oil anymore. And probably they're going to choose not to, hopefully.
So, I hope.
Hopefully, yes.
Well, and as you're talking, Emily, it makes me think too, the skills that you, those non-visual techniques and skills that you learn in the orientation center, it doesn't matter if you're high partial, if you have, it doesn't matter. It doesn't discriminate. These skills and techniques work across the board. Whereas probably young Emily, as she's learning these skills and she's losing more vision, okay, maybe that skill worked for a year and now it doesn't anymore. And so, mm-hmm. You know, it's constantly changing. Whereas those non-visual techniques, I mean, they work regardless of where you are on that hierarchy of vision.
You know,
and when I was a kid, I was told I was going to be high partial for the rest of my life, that my vision was, it might change a little bit, but it wasn't going to change a whole lot. They were flat out wrong about that. They did not know they had RP.
After they told you failed the test, they're like, but don't worry, you won't fail the test even more later in life. I mean, is that?
Every eye doctor said, oh, this is going to stay stable. You know, this is going to be the amount of vision you have. You might just lose a little bit as you age, like everybody else does. And that was what they had thought. Nobody had thought that I had RP or that my retinas would degenerate as they are doing now in my 40s. So they were just, you know, proceeding like, okay, so we're just going to focus on the visual and just maximize, maximize, maximize.
Which again reinforces all of those negative stigmas about blindness. Like, okay, thank goodness you're going to, you know, it's a self-perpetuating cycle.
Oh yeah. And I'm really sure that had I not gone to the center, and I didn't even know when I was going through the center that I was going to lose vision in later life. I did not think that I would. And poor Sandy Tegas had a lot of arguments for me in business class around that, about how I didn't need this because I wasn't going to lose more vision. So.
Sure. Those went over well with her.
You
know, and here's the thing. So this does bring up though, the horrible misconception about shades as to why we use them. And I am like lately so the number of interviews I've sat through where someone's, what's the reason behind using the shades? Okay. And the answer comes back. Emily, you know the answer, right? That comes mm-hmm. back. What is it?
I do too.
I want to not hire people who say this.
Okay. Here's
an interview tip for anybody listening to this. Do not say this. This will lose you points a lot.
Well, because people might lose vision later at some point, and this then prepares them for that. I have now gotten to the point because, I don't know, whatever I was saying before was not blunt enough. And so nowadays there's times where I talk to staff in training or I talk to students, which staff in training to me, you know, they're the same as a student. So there's no differentiation there. But anyone who's going through the center, I am like pretty just blunt and honest anymore in business class. I did have a staff in training answer the question that way. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to stop you. Like normally I'll shine you on and say, yeah, you know, that's one of the reasons. No, I'm just stopping people now at this point when I hear it, because I just feel like I need to. It is not the reason we use shades. It's not. I do like to say it's a nice side benefit. You know, and the disclaimer at the end in the small print, it would be there. Along with all the other side effects that training cause, you know, heightened confidence, better attitude, blah, blah, blah. Maybe we should have that, by the way. just thinking about that now is fine print, all these like great things. The opposite of any kind of pharmaceutical. So,
but, your counselor, if the center is right for you, benefits may include.
Side effects might include heightened confidence, all those things.
I actually really like this for a yoga thing or something.
There is something to me about that statement, and I understand why people say it, but it really is nails on a chalkboard to me more and more, not because it's completely, well, it is completely wrong in the way I think, but I can understand why they would say that, because it is a side effect. And the problem, the reason I have a problem with it is this, and Emily, you can probably contest this too, which is, I went through center training when my vision was substantially higher, or whatever you want to say, than what it is now. Okay. I was a partial at that time, pretty high partial. And, you know, and so I did gradually lose vision. But here's the thing. I kind of, along the way, it was relearning or rehoning some skills along the way. So I never had to go back through training. I never had to go back through training because I'd already learned those once, and they come back pretty quick, right? The stuff that I was using, it just became this whole thing of like, I knew how to do the things non-visually. And although maybe I didn't do them all the time or practice them all the time, although mine kind of verged around, it's like, well, if the light wasn't right. So, you know, I would use the non-visual stuff a lot more and just kind of back and forth. That ratio then changed, obviously, as time went on. However, if that was the only reason why you were using shades, I think that at the end of your training, you would end up losing everything at that point, because the stuff that you're not going to use, you're just not going to use, right? I mean, we know that if you don't use skills, they diminish. You know, and so would that really be a reason at that point? And I would say no. Yeah, well, but I probably have some thoughts on it too, because I know it probably hurts you as much as me. And
oh yeah, I have that same visceral reaction to it. And I think a lot of it though stems from them when that answer is given, the real answer is pushed to the side. And I want that real answer to be out there front and center and just repeated and just beat into people's minds about why we do, why the sleep shades. And because we need that intense practice to get these skills down and get them down good and get them down good and solid. So that, yeah, even if you do not use it particularly great, you know, after you leave, that you pick it up when you need it, and it's not maybe, you know, on the level of you haven't had the level of practice that you had with sight, because we're, you know, all the time everywhere with that. But we need to have that intensive 6, 9, 12 months of you just hitting on this skill and getting it to become second nature, so that you have mastered it and you can carry it with you.
All right. So let's talk about it, right? Somebody gets asked that question, right? So you've made it this way through the podcast. Here's a bonus, because like, you know, how to answer the question. I look at it a couple reasons, all right? That's not one of them. There's someone screaming outside my window, so if you hear that, it's out of the norm. Hey, I look at it like one of the reasons, because it is much more efficient to learn the non-visual skills while you're using sleep shades. It's one of those things where if you're focusing on the non-visual skills rather than not burning your face in the boiling oil, it makes it much more efficient to learn those skills.
Well, I think there's more than that too. I mean, well, looking at it from like the way our brains work, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, our brain is hardwired to trust our vision even when it's faulty. So I don't know if anyone's had that sensation while they're like in a car and the car next to you is backing up and it feels like you're going forward because from your peripheral. There's another experiment of, there's a fake hand that you see and they smash it with a hammer and you experience physical pain because you think it's your hand because visually that's what you see.
Where do you hang out in the evenings?
I'm a nerd.
Well, and Ray Kurzweil goes into this a fair bit too, and he in his books on the brain and how the brain gets rewired and the cerebral cortex and a lot of really smart things I can't even get, I hardly get my head around.
Right. But so if you are trying to use your vision while learning the non-visual techniques, you're not going to fully learn the non-visual technique because our brain will not let us, because it's still, even though if you're not trying to, it's still going to be gathering and using those, that visual information. And so there is not a way to fully learn the non-visual technique with utilizing vision. There's just not a way.
So, and you know, my biggest one, right, as to what, and I think about myself, okay, I was hard-headed. It's funny because Emily, I think, was very hard-headed too, and so was I. And so you're trying to pump me full of stuff and information and tell me what it is. And I'm never going to believe you until I believe it myself. I mean, until I've proved it to myself or disproved it to myself. And what made the ultimate difference to me, and this is why I still say, is like when you get out of training, you're not going to be at 100% of where you're going to be with that adjustment piece, right? That whole adjustment to blindness piece, which is okay with yourself. I think one of the biggest reasons for me in using shades is because taking the vision out of it and being successful, okay? Being successful, not using vision, starts to change your perception of yourself. And that's what it took for me. And so then moving forward afterwards, right, as I was successful as a blind person, that was what it finally got to the point to where I could say, I'm a blind person without it feeling like gravel in my mouth. I'm a blind person and I'm successful. And all of a sudden it went from, you know, that's normal to not even really thinking about it. Okay, that it's
a non-issue.
It's a non-issue. And I've said to people before at times, and I've tried to explain, I was like, look, if you're a student and I have you go around home block, let's say, and you're not wearing shades. Okay, and something happens and you're not successful, right? Because you miss a curb or whatever the case might be. You're gonna blame that on your blindness. Now, if they send you around home block and you're not wearing shades and you're successful, you're going to attribute that to your success, to the little bit of vision that you have left. You know, you would blame that. Now, taking vision out of the equation altogether, it doesn't play a part in your success or your failure, right? You might at first think some of your failures are due to the fact that you have to wear these shades, but over time with the successes and as the successes rack up, this puts you back more into a mindset, at least it did with me. And I think I've seen it with a number of students when you talk to them, that if you take vision out of the equation, they no longer feel like the deck is stacked against them. Okay. You're competing in a visual world, but if you've proved to yourself that with non-visual techniques and with these skills and with proper attitude that you can complete tasks, that you can be successful, that changes the perception of yourself, right? From one where my world is coming to an end, or, you know, somewhere around that level. I know not everybody comes in with that, but I think there's a lot more students, and I've heard Emily point this out to students before too, and so have I. It's like, you've got a knot in your stomach, you know it's there, that's fear, right? And it's fear of all these things. And our job here is to get rid of that, right? Our job here is to work with you so that you can get rid of that, right? And that, I think, becomes that belief, because we can't get rid of it for you. It's you doing these tasks. It's you really putting in the time and really putting in the effort, completing things non-visually and being successful, that changes your life forever. I know students get out of the center and they go back to sitting on a couch and the confidence wanes and that kind of thing. And that's why it's so important that what happens after the center is almost, you know, that last, I don't know whether it's the last 20%, to independence or something, but it it is almost as important or more important than all the time you put in the center. I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on that part of it.
Well, I also think too, looking at also from, because we do have staff and training who come through, and we require our staff and training regardless of if they have 20/20 vision or what or not, or it doesn't matter. We have everyone wear sleep shades as well. And I think it also plays a part in, it changes people from, rather than just playing lip service to, oh yeah, blind people can do this or that, to really believing because they're doing it themselves. I think that is so important too for having our employees. I mean, not just saying, yeah, a blind person can cross the street, but really knowing that a blind person can cross the street because they themselves did it.
Emily?
Yeah, so this is the part where people will watch me just go completely emotional. And
you guys know, I'm trying to push Emily's buttons.
Incredibly emphatic, I guess. You pushed all the buttons. And I do this particularly in new staff seminar, and sometimes when in business class with the students, I will, when I tell the story of where I was going into training and what happened to me in training, I really was at a terrible point in my life when I came into training. I had just attempted suicide. I was so convinced that I could not live the life that I wanted to live in the world and do the things that I wanted to do because I couldn't see. And I saw that as an immovable barrier. And I saw myself as just absolutely less than everybody else around me. And that there was nothing I could do about that. And to me, that was just such a terrible thought. I couldn't bear it. And the center was a last ditch attempt to convince myself otherwise. And I was very hard to convince. I'm very stubborn in holding on to my beliefs, but eventually over time, seeing myself be able to do things non-visually, not just once, but repeatedly, and being able to get good at it and developing that confidence and that understanding that this was not going to be a thing that weighed me down for the whole rest of my life. And that I can't explain it other than just an immense lightness. Like I felt like I've been carrying around 50 extra pounds my entire life. And it was eventually just, and a lot of it had to do with doing my graduation walk and achieving that. But just having that complete change of framework. And to me, that's when you want to talk about like number one on Jernigan's list of in the dishwashing tape. I think that's, you get the skills and the attitude and then melding into that place where you have that sense of yourself as a whole person. And this is why I get like, the joke is I have to wear super absorbent sleep shades to graduations. Because to me, when you have achieved a graduation and when you have come to a place where you are starting, maybe you're not fully there, but you're starting to understand that you are a whole person, and watching the people who have done that, it just, it makes me tear up because it's a complete and total life change. It just is. And honestly, the center gave me my life back because I was, and I could not have done, you know, without it. And that became such a powerful thing to me. I had to go teach others and a motivation, but just to watch that, just to see that process starting. That's what it's really all about. That's what number one means, is that you're getting to that place.
Yeah. It's always funny because Emily and I wear our hearts on our sleeves usually with the, with like new staff seminar. Sorry, Nami, you don't get to spend time going back through new staff seminar.
I'd rather be teaching anyway.
I feel like you're using reverse psychology on me right now. It's like the people who come to me and they're like, you know, I really don't feel comfortable in the shop, so I would like to stay out of there. And then they know I'll send them there or something. So, but yeah, Emily and I definitely kind of wear our hearts on our sleeves during that. But in reality, I always kind of went into it with the thought that I need people to understand the impact, right? I need staff in this agency to understand, at least from my perspective, what it did in my life, the changes that it made. It would have never worked for me doing it visually. it would not. If I came through the center at that time, I didn't use shades, that I would not have been as successful as I've been. I don't know what successes I would have. I'm not sure what failures I'd have, and I don't like to think about it. And you know, I look at my future now. Blindness is not the thing that I think about when I think about my future. Believe me, I've got plenty of other things I think about. Maybe, you know, and what shoes I want to buy, suits, clothes, all kinds of stuff. But blindness doesn't happen to be the thing going, oh, geez, but if I just wasn't blind, or if this wasn't holding me back, that's not a part of my life. And it's interesting because I sometimes talk to students as they're going through training, and I will ask them at times when we're more in a private conversation or something, I'll say, how often are you thinking about, you know, being blind, or being blind sucks, or that kind of thing? I mean, how often does that cross through your, and it's interesting over time because it lessens, even though they don't quite realize, and they don't quite realize that's happening. You know, that becomes less of an issue in their life. Nami, as you kind of said, less of an issue. There is kind of a final thing in that dishwashing tape that he starts getting into, Nami, which is
why they came to the conclusion of who's washing the dishes and who's not. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, no, although that was funny to watch Craig kind of like go around, and it was also interesting for me to hear Roy. I think it was Roy in there who basically says, well, I'm not going to do it.
I'm not going to learn.
Emily, I don't know if you picked up on that little part.
Yeah.
just so everybody knows, Emily's definitely cut her teeth on teaching in all the different areas. And so I'm listening to this, and I'm hearing Dr. Jernigan say, well, I think you will be. He's like, no, I'm not going to try that ever. I was like, well,
I'll do it at home, but I won't do it here.
I won't do it here. I was like, well, and I guess I'll keep working on getting you to try it. Which I thought was a very diplomatic, because I was sitting there listening to that. I was like, oh, he's not going to win this. He's not going to win this, like, butting of heads, because that happens mm-hmm. around the center quite a bit with students. So what do? Do you back down completely? I thought that was a nice way of putting it. A little side reference that I thought that was funny with Roy. Is talking more about like the public perceptions, Nami.
Oh yeah.
You know, in looking at, and I did talk to, so I did a business class this morning, and I told Nami what it was, and she's like, well, you must have been listening to the dishwashing tape. And it was more off of this other stuff, but it was dealing with accommodations. And then how those verge into entitlements of people and feeling entitled. And then also, what does that do in the end? And so talking about public perceptions. And I think he delves into it right with, refresh me, Nami, on how he gets around to that. I say Nami because I think she has this tape memorized.
Hey, bye. Basically do. It's funny because when a student's going over it, I start out by introducing it and what I talk about. And if I'm in the room, I just start quoting it and then I have to leave because I'm distracting. So yeah. I basically do have it memorized. But yeah.
Yeah, would that have worked for you? Let's say, Emily, if you were listening to it on your first day, if you just had a person in the room with you quoting.
Yeah, I wanted the dramatic reenactment. You know, I really like acted out for me. That'd be awesome.
Like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead, Nami.
And I try to do it in his voice, which I can't do a good impression. No, so I mean, by the end, they're kind of going to like, well, do you contribute to the attitudes that we complain about? Do you take advantage of your blindness? Like, having your cake and eat it too is kind of how he put it. Like, when you want something or want to do something, don't tell me that I can't do this. You know, I can do anything I want to do. Doesn't matter if I'm blind, but let's say it's raining, he says, or something's heavy or something you just don't want to do. And it has nothing to do with your blindness, but you just, you know, oh man, I don't really want to go out because it's hailing, but the garbage man's going to be here in an hour. And someone's like, well, I got it. Do you say, yeah, okay, great. Even though you know it's because they don't think you can do it as a blind person. And if so, he says, you're contributing to this perception of blindness that the public has. And so you're really doing nothing to benefit this belief about blindness that, they kind of go on to talk about examples of where they've done that in their lives or fought it. And I really like how Jernigan, you know, is honest. He's like, you know, I did that when I was in college. I had roommates who, you know, they took turns cooking and I didn't want to cook. You couldn't make me cook. So I said, yeah, I can't do it because I'm blind. I'll wash the dishes.
He talked about it with that. And then also with the furniture and staining furniture that moves into a little different part of it as far as, you know, continuing to learn. But Emily,
well, for the furniture part, I thought that was more challenge yourself, even though because you're part of the public, and where is that really a truth, or is it some like, oh, I can't do this because I'm blind? Where is that coming from? Is it because you really genuinely can't, or is it because that's what you've been told?
Yeah, and I appreciated how he was, like you said, how honest he was being about it, and how he continued to press everybody else to have, you know, search your soul, Craig, you know.
I would like you to quote that to him at some point. That would be Craig still around. Craig was former director of this agency, and he happens to be on this tape. So
it's so crazy hearing a young who's my favorite part is like when he's like, honestly, I don't know who's blind, who's total, and who's partial. And he's like, Craig, I assume that you're partial from how you're arguing. I love it. But he does talk about like that perception of blindness and what is your role in that perception of blindness? You know, our role is to hopefully educate, but are you doing the opposite? And so, you know, I thought, and it was interesting too, because he kind of pauses and it's just silence, you know, like the students are probably like, oh man, what do I do? You could tell that they were really kind of thinking about that.
The business class this morning, I had said to somebody, I was like, boy, if I just had a pipe I could tap on the, if I just had a pipe I could tap in an ashtray and then wait for you guys to answer me, I would be able to just sit back and wait for you to answer questions. But
for a business class one time during dead time, I played the Jeopardy song and it didn't go over very well. So don't try that one.
Well, so one of the things I did bring, and that was the thing where Nami had kind of said, was because I talked about, you know, you get a job, right? And you do your best to get people to understand that you can do the job or that you should be hired for a job. And I knew going into that business class, because this one was open to a lot of staff as well. And so around here, for me to kind of get people to always go in a direction that I know they're not going to go, it takes a little bit extra effort. I was trying to find things where people were asking for an accommodation that seems like maybe it's because, or something that's given to somebody as an accommodation, but it's a little bit more of an entitlement thing and that kind of thing. One of the examples was, well, if you have someone who's in a nursing home and because they're blind, they get the meals brought to them in their room instead of having to go to the chow hall or whatever they call it in a nursing home. Pretty sure they don't call it chow hall. Dining room probably would be a better description. It's not Shawshank. So, you know, that was one of the things. And I always know that if I finally, like Joy said, she says, well, you're not going to find this around here, but right. Which was, I was trying to get people to say, give me the stereotypes, right? one of the things I brought up was one of our maintenance guys who cleans out the cooling tower, and it's a horrible job. It's not a fun job. Blind guy. And I said, well, I think maybe because you're blind, you're probably not doing as good of a job as Scott over here could do. And so, Scott, maybe you could just do that from now on, and we'll find something that's maybe a little more suited for this guy. He didn't like that idea. But I said, you know, and I don't say it's because of blindness. And I just say, well, it's just because, you know, we're going to shift duties around. And you don't have to clean out the cooling tower anymore. So are you going to complain? No, you're not going to complain. And so all of a sudden now, this isn't really an accommodation so much as you're getting something because you're blind that you didn't really ask for. Are you willing to turn it down? Are you willing to turn down the extra help? I mean, if I'm moving boxes and Nami comes along and says, no, I'll do that. Right. And maybe she's thinking in her back of her head, she's like, this guy's going to take forever because he's carrying a cane and he's carrying a box. Now, just so you know, Nami would never do this. She might ask if she could help. Not based off of sight or blindness or any of that, but based off of just because she would help. But my point is, like, other in society, what does that then do to, like, everybody else around you, right? They, in their mind, say you need this accommodation or entitlement, but then they resent you for it, right? And what have you done? So you've worked towards getting people to understand blindness, and then it's much easier than to get them to go back to the stereotypes that you, now all of a sudden you're proving the stereotypes are true.
I've seen the opposite as well. I have a friend who she went to work for a lighthouse for the blind, and she gets employed, and the employer is like, well, we already employ other blind people, so we already know that you're going to need X and Y and Z and Q and all of these things. And she's like, I don't need those. And her coworker's like, shut up.
I don't.
Like, don't tell them that. Like,
why are you ruining this for all of us?
Yeah. And she eventually got let go because she'd go into the sheltered workshop and sit down with people and be like, you can do so much more. Why are you here? So she eventually got let go.
I could see how that might cause some angst.
Yeah.
Emily, you got any
thoughts? Actually, the VR agency should have actually hired her at that point, because that's what they need to be required to do under Section 511. So, you know.
Thoughts on that, Emily, as far as that kind of, I think, you know, he's talking about perceptions, and I took it maybe a little further than that just because of what I was talking about in business class today, but changing those perceptions and those stereotypes. He uses the sentence, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah. And I think that's always a challenging one to take. The thing that always, it made it really struck me this time listening to it, because there's another speech that Jernigan gives. It's embedded in another speech, but this kind of portion is referred to as don't throw the nickel.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He's at a bus stop and this older lady wants to give him a nickel and he doesn't want to take the nickel and he's insulted and he gets mad and he throws the nickel and then he feels bad later that he went and threw the nickel. And I've always kind of struggled with that over the years, because I'm like, heck yeah, I'd throw the nickel really far. And that's kind of my personality and attitude towards things. But the level of patience and understanding and looking at the long game that he demonstrates, you know, particularly here in the dishwashing tape, but you can see it throughout his later writings and speeches as well. I've always admired that a lot and really appreciated it. The challenge that I've always found, though, too, is kind of the flip side of it, in that you get so worried about making a good impression in the public and really demonstrating what blind people can do and being that, you know, that good blind person that's really changing the world for other blind people, right? And one time you slip up because you're having a bad day. You know, that you just, you know, you, somebody threw, give you the nickel and you throw it because you just couldn't take it. It's, you know, you're just not in the right place to do it. I've been in that situation. Then I felt just so incredibly guilty about it. Like, oh, I've ruined everything for blind people. And I think that that's one of the challenges that I noticed running into that with students when trying to get this across, you know, when I was working in the center, about how to be in balance about that, where you're not really making yourself feel terrible if you don't happen to be the best model blind person on a particular day, but working towards, you know, developing that patience and being as good as you possibly can on that.
I joke that I can handle like a negative public perception of blindness 20 times, and then that 21st time I snap good for another 20 times. There was one time a bunch of students and staff went and did Meals for the Heartland, and I happened to be the only sighted person in the group. But oh, I was
not the caretaker. Nice.
Yeah, I was not the one who set it up. Another supervisor, Helen Stevens, is the one who set it up. And so she was in charge of it all. She made the plan of how we were going to get there, what time to leave, all that stuff, like figured out, you know, where to show up and all this. And so we get there and the woman's like, wait here. And she's talking specifically to me. And she turns to me and she's like, it's so nice that you brought them out to help. And I just snapped. It was that 21st time, you know. I feel Helen's hand on my shoulder. Like, you need to come. But I was like, she's in charge. And I like went to the back of the group and we get to our table and Helen's like, probably not the best way to handle that situation. But then I was good for another 20 times. So
yeah. It's good. It's good, Nami. I'm glad you have this angst built up in you over the years. At times, other times I don't.
Well, I mean, I think it's a constant challenge to keep increasing that level, to try and get that up to 25 and then trying to get it up to 30.
Good goal. I like that.
And you know, I feel like that's a constant process. And in trying to, you know, not beating up yourself for that time when you snap, but just then working to increase that level. I mean, that's something I feel like I've been doing for 20 plus years now. And still, I don't know that I'm set at 20 even. I might be set still at 15.
It depends on the day, right? I mean, yeah. These other things that come into it, you know, it's not something where you can sit there and be perfect all the time. It's something we say all the time. It's like, look, everybody's a human being and everybody has good days and bad days. And, you know, there's no exceptions there. So,
I think that's where a lot of the, where people really feel very, a great, strong connection and a real, with, you know, Jernigan's work and life, I think has to do with a lot of the way that he, and I'm sure he didn't do it absolutely perfectly. I'm sure he snapped every once in a while. but the way that he was able to take that long view and, you know, really put that forth, as a way to create long-term, you know, social change. And I do think that it's making a difference. You know, it's just not as quick as we want.
Not as quick as we'd like. It is interesting. I mean, there's a reason why I think this tape is still listened to. It would be nice to come a day where it's like, well, that tape doesn't have anything relevant on it anymore. I don't think that would ever happen. So,
Well, and what I love about it too is it's not just being taught here in Iowa. Like I said, the first time I heard it, I was in Colorado. When I went to Louisiana for training, I heard it there. I think it's not just something here in Iowa. It spans time. It spans geography.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons, I mean, we have it available for people to hear, and I would encourage anybody who's listened to this who hasn't heard the dishwashing tape, these are links off of our website. It is sitting on in our YouTube channel. Is that correct, Emily?
I would need to double check that.
I believe it's there.
It is.
I think there's a link off of our website to it directly.
Well, and if you just go to YouTube and write in the dishwashing tape, our link is the first one that pops up.
Oh, nice. Very good. Something's happening great there then. Emily, thank you very much for joining Nami and I on the Center podcast. This has been good. We're going to continue to do these. We'll probably do them over Zoom because it's easy for right now until we get back to the real world or something, whatever that is at this point, normalcy. So thank you very much. And thanks for listening to our long form podcast. I love that term. And but it does give us a chance to kind of hash stuff out. So any final thoughts, plugs, Emily, anything that you want to throw in there? I know, I'm putting her on the spot.
No, I would just encourage folks to check that out on our YouTube channel and everything else on our YouTube channel that they haven't. And, you know, I always want to put in a plug for the library podcast, too.
Oh, yeah.
And when I, and I always put a plug in for my director's forums on the third Friday of the month, each month from noon to one. If you sign up for our newsletters, which I encourage folks to do also, you'll get a reminder sent to you for that and the Zoom link and everything. So that's where if anybody wants to know anything about what's going on at the agency as a whole, give a lot of updates and answer people's questions. And so I want to keep kind of people up to date on how, I mean, there's so much going on. So
there is a lot as well. So it's kind of funny. I was like, I wonder where she'll go with this if I let her throw some plugs in there, because I know you could go on for the next 20 to 30 minutes with like, oh, this is going on and this is going on. This is coming up. And a lot of great stuff happening at this agency. And Emily is a lot of the driving force behind that. So, Emily, thank you very much for coming on. And we hopefully I'll have some more out there for you to listen to in the future.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Okay, bye, Nami. See you guys.